head to congas.com/podcast to follow along with today's episode. And make sure you're hitting subscribe on Apple Music, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Front Lounge with Congos. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Adam Reamer. We've known him for a long time, and we'll get into how we met. He's in the music business. He works at Warner Brothers Records, and his official title is Director of Fan Engagement Strategies. Did I get that right?
You nailed it.
Welcome, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we were just saying how that sounds a bit like a relic of the past, a propaganda post, maybe.
Our department title has changed like 12 times over the last 4 years. We were like new media for a while, digital marketing, interactive marketing, and now we're fan engagement. So it'll change again in a year, I'm sure.
Keeps getting how many fans have you married? Well, why don't we start by talking about how we met, and then we'll get into what you do and how it relates to the music business and the music itself. We have a pretty cool story of how we met, and maybe it'd be kind of fun to hear our perspective of it and then your perspective of it.
I love it.
We'll start with ours. We in 2012, we had been back and forth to South Africa a bunch of times to do shows, and before we had any success anywhere, we had some success in South Africa on the radio and played some big shows, and somehow we landed this opening slot for Linkin Park at their two stadium shows in Johannesburg and Cape Town. So we went, did these shows. It was at the end of the year. It was like a highlight for us. You know, 65,000 people at Johannesburg alone is the biggest show we've ever done to date. And then, you know, we flew home, and we flew on Virgin Airlines, and we were looking at Twitter, like recapping all the fans, you know, tweets and stuff. And we saw this guy, tweet, says, "Hey, I just saw the guys from Congas. They're on my flight." And anyway, we ended up sort of bumping into this guy Adam, and we had a layover in London. We spent 7 hours together just hanging out and catching up, and because he was working for Linkin Park at the time, he was doing their digital social media stuff like that, taking photos and the online promotion of their tour stuff. So it was a really funny way that we met, and we sat in the Virgin Lounge for like literally 7 hours.
We
drank free drinks and ate free food and then chatted.
Should make it clear that the promoter had paid for us to fly out on Virgin and got us into, they don't even call it the first class lounge, they call it the upper class lounge.
Oh, right.
Just to make everyone feel even worse about themselves. So on the way back, we weren't actually getting into the lounge. We had to kind of beg and plead. Something went wrong with the arrangements.
Yeah.
And we had this whole idea. We're like, oh, we should just invite this guy to come hang out with us because he's got to sit in Heathrow for 7 hours. We walk up to the front desk and say, "Can we bring a guest?" And like, "You're not even on the list. You can't bring a guest."
I don't remember that.
So we argued and hassled. They eventually let us in, and then we're like, "Okay, can we get him in also?"
Well, you're okay. The thing that you're leaving out is that they said, "Yes, you can bring him in, but you have to pay." And you guys very graciously paid for me to sit in the Virgin Lounge with you guys.
That was part of our fan engagement program.
I think that was the last ditch recovery of like, oh, Jesus, we've offered this guy.
It's like when you got here and we offered you a beer, and then we looked in the fridge and we realized we didn't have any beer. So we're getting...
Yeah.
We've come full circle. Yeah.
It's actually a tactic we've learned to use.
That's so... Yeah, that's...
Get the credit for the offer, but then you don't have to deliver, you know? Well, in this case, I guess.
That's a really... that's so funny. That was a great story because, you know, I ran Linkin Park's fan club for 5.5 years, did all their social media, toured with them for a while. So all my followers on Twitter are like hardcore Linkin Park fans. And so I like... When I would be out on the road with them, I would like to live tweet kind of cool things that were happening. And when the opening band would come on or my plane, I just thought that was something that's funny. I didn't know you guys saw that tweet.
We at that time we were scouring Twitter after every show just to see if anybody liked us, you know.
And those were some incredible shows. I actually just read something from a fan site like a week ago that Johannesburg show was Linkin Park's biggest headline show ever. Not counting festivals. Or
I believe.
Like that.
I mean, I think a lot of people do their biggest shows in South Africa because
it's because we were playing.
Yeah, right. They all came for you guys.
You know, it's been such a closed market for so long, and then when you go there, it is it's a big country, but it's also concentrated in two or three main cities. So yeah, that's the biggest show we've ever played. I think it's the biggest show we'll ever play, even if we were to blow up and become massive, huge band. Like, you just don't get to play in front of 65,000 people as a headline.
It's one of the biggest stadiums in the world. Yeah, it's a 95,000 cap stadium or something like that.
And it was just so, to your point, that they've been closed off for so long that the I've seen Linkin Park play everywhere in the world, and those fans just went off because, you know, they may never see them again, and it was the first time they'd ever seen them. And those were just some of those. I mean, that 10 days I spent in South Africa were some of the most incredible experiences
in Cape Town. The wind was blowing the PA incredible. Around, so you couldn't really hear the PA, but it didn't matter because the crowd was louder than any crowd I've ever heard.
It was a really bad windstorm.
Was that your first time in South Africa?
First and only time, and I would love to go back except for that terrible flight to get there because that was awful.
You just have to fly upper class.
Yeah, right.
We'll talk more about the Linkin Park stuff, I think, coming up. But what have you been up to, Adam? What can you tell us? Because you still are sort of somewhat connected with Linkin Park, but you moved over to Warner Brothers in the last, 5-6 years?
Yeah, it'll be 5 years in June. So yeah, I in 2013, I had just been touring for a year and 2 years with Linkin Park. I had been there 5.5 years, and I was just kind of ready for something new. And one of my friends who worked at the record label, Warner Brothers, hit me up and said, "You should just come work here." And at first I was like, "Not a chance. I'm not going to work for a major record label. I have zero desire to do that." And he was very convincing. And so I've been there about 5 years now at Warner Brothers. And it's great because I actually still get to work with Linkin Park. I've worked on the last few albums of theirs from the label side. And so that's been really cool that this will be 10 years now that I've been working with Linkin Park. So it's fun to do it from this other side.
Can you talk a little bit about why you had that initial thought? Like, no fucking way am I working at a major label. Like, what is it that most people have an opposition to that? And then what changed and how has it been good?
Well, coming from the artist side, I mean, my bosses were Linkin Park. Like, I didn't work for their management company. I worked for the band. And so really, I always kind of felt like my job with them was to make sure that everything that they were being asked to do, you know, specifically on social media, digital, reflected their brand correctly. And I feel like with a label, sometimes those waters get real murky and they ask you to do things that are like, oh, you guys know this, I'm sure. And so I don't know, I coming from the artist side, it just felt, I had zero desire to do that.
Right.
But it's been great because I have that perspective. And so I pride myself on that. I can come from the side of the artist that not a lot of people at the label can, because I've been there.
Right.
And so I hope I don't ask my bands to do too much ridiculous things.
You've been around them when they start, you know, mumbling under their breath or complaining about what the label's asking them to do. And so,
well, that's right. And you know, even things like meet and greets after shows, it's like, they're exhausted. The bands have played an hour and a half show, and the last thing they want to do sometimes is like meet a bunch of people from the label that they don't know. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are artists in Linkin Park, they've always been very gracious about that. And you know, most artists are, but I kind of know that like they have zero desire to like interact with me. So,
well, yeah, I mean, we have there's a difference between a meet and greet with fans. 99% of the time you actually look forward to that, 'cause that's what you're big part of why you're doing it. But very often you do get a request from the label. We need you to meet Mr. Suit X from radio station X that's coming in. And they always start off with like, he's one of the real guys, you know, he's a no bullshit guy.
Yeah.
He just cares about music. He's not about the business. We'd love to meet you guys.
We heard that exact like scripted speech 4 times in a row when people were being introduced to us. And
that's kind of one of the lessons I think I learned touring with and working with Linkin Park for so long, is that when I was on the road with them, I always tried my best to like stay out of sight and out of mind and like let them do their thing. And they only need to see me when they need to see me. And that was it. And so I really try to take that same approach with my artists now. Like, to be honest, interacting with artists is my least favorite thing about working.
Artists too.
Adam, why don't you just get the fuck out of here? Right?
Except for you guys. Well, and I think it's because like, I don't know, like I'm not a musician. I nerd out over analytics, and sometimes artists think that's really cool. Sometimes they just don't care. But I also know that, like, we're not friends. Like, I'm not friends with my artists, and sometimes that line gets blurred. And to me, it's like, no, this is like a professional relationship we're in here, and that's kind of it. Like, I don't need to be best friends with all my artists.
So who are some of the artists you're working with now?
So in addition to Linkin Park, let's see, this last year I worked on Liam Gallagher from Oasis, which was interesting. Awesome, but interesting.
Oh, yeah, we have to come back to this in our why. What's it like playing in a band with your brothers?
Oh, there
section.
You go. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite bands I work on is Mastodon. They they're just a blast, and I just think they're incredible. I mean, I've worked on everything from Kid Rock to Disturbed to Regina Spektor. Sleeping with Sirens is a band I'm working on now. So mostly rock alternative stuff. And I think next year I'm working on Michael Bublé, which is a blast, actually. I love working on Michael Bublé.
So now when you say working on, why don't you just give a brief sort of description of your job?
Sure. So, it varies a lot depending on who it is, because I do mostly like digital marketing, social media, fan engagement stuff. And, you know, a lot of teams have their own social guy who runs all their accounts for them. So sometimes it's just me interacting with them. And, other times I'm running I'm doing posts on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. It's really coming up with strategy, cool ideas, ways to grow our social followings, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, setting up a Reddit AMA.
So the online world, connecting the artists to the online world and growing that and making sure that the fans are sort of kept up to date on every single platform. And there's a lot of platforms.
I'd imagine that department has only grown. I mean, you were doing this for Linkin Park, and I remember you were one of the, you got them to have like 45 million Facebook fans or something before people realized what was going
on. I'm the one who started all their accounts. Right. I'm the one who signed them up for Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and now they've got like 63 million, fans on Facebook.
How has it changed since then? Obviously now it's...
Yeah,
now it is the mainstream.
Now it is, and I think that was the thing with them is like they realized that how important it was early on, which is why they've got 63 million fans on Facebook now or whatever they've got. So, I mean, and how it's changed is that best practices on all those things are changing constantly. You know, I remember when it was we have to post a photo with every post we do, and now it's we have to make video for every post we do, and now we have to create vertical videos for Instagram stories in addition to horizontal videos for Facebook, and they've got to be a certain length, and we're cutting 12 different pieces of content for all the platforms. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's fun. That's the kind of fun stuff of digging in then and looking at the analytics and saying, like, this is working. Like, let's keep doing this. And then lo and behold, 3 months later, that doesn't work anymore and you have to change your strategy again.
So without giving away too much specifics, a lot of artists have a guy that's learned their, quote, voice and is doing 90% of their tweets for them because a lot of times they're just not interested in doing it, or other times they're just too busy to do that. So it's a funny thing, I imagine, for people to think about who they're actually interacting with when they're tweeting at somebody saying, hey, I loved your show yesterday, and the person replies, loved it too, and it's not the person. You're talking to you.
Yeah, well, or sometimes, right? Like, individual accounts, again, Linkin Park, just as an example, like Mike Shinoda runs his own Twitter account and own Instagram account. I don't do anything on there. But the band account, like, and I like that you use the word voice, is like, that's so vitally important. And especially at a label where I've got 16 artists and we're signing and dropping artists constantly, I'm always having to learn the new voice. Like, I just started working on Michael Bublé 2 months ago, and I sent management a post, like copy for a post, and I just said, I don't know your voice yet, so like let me know if I'm on the right track. Here's a few examples. And thank God they said, oh, you nailed it. And I was like, okay, I got this one. Whereas I had an artist like 3 years ago and I worked on them for a year, and their management was never happy with the voice. That they need to sound cooler. I'm like, I don't really know what that means.
Do you ever mix up voices? Do you ever mix up Disturbed and Michael Bublé?
I have never. My biggest fear is posting for a Disturbed post on like Michael Bublé's Facebook page, and I've come close a couple times, because if you look at my phone, I'm logged into like 50 Twitter accounts and like 10 Instagram accounts and my YouTube. I think I can YouTube manage 25 accounts right now.
You need some pretty serious security on your phone.
You know what scares me is Twitter is my favorite place to check out stuff, you know, just because you can go down crazy rabbit holes and you can enter the end of the universe on there. But it's so easy to accidentally like something, or it's like do you keep your thumb on the very right of the screen? That's what, my method.
Okay, I'm not going to name the specific artist, but this happened. It wasn't me. A year or so ago, where one of our smaller artists sent a tweet or sent a email to their digital guy and just said, "I can't believe that so and so followed me on Instagram. Like, oh my god, this is amazing!" And we were like, "That's why would this person follow?" And sure enough, it was like a mistake. The social guy accidentally did it, and it happens. I've never done it.
It's kind of like when the U.S. Marines puts out a tweet that says, Julian Assange in quotes when they meant to search.
Did you see that shit?
They meant to search for Julian Assange, but
the U.S. Navy accidentally tweeted Julian Assange yesterday. It was really bizarre.
And then they deleted it.
Whatever it was, a few days
ago. Okay,
and then
I have
like we accidentally pressed the wrong keystroke.
Okay, I have so much sympathy when that happens because it happens all the time where clearly like someone did something. And everyone jumps all over. I'm like, oh, what an idiot! It's like I have so much sympathy for them because like I know like it's terrifying sometimes.
They really
what's the guy? Who's the guy?
Anthony Weiner, you know?
Well, I mean, I don't have any.
Who's the guy? The guy who just liked porn.
Ted Cruz.
Cruz, yeah, that was hilarious. He liked a porn thing on Twitter by mistake.
They really need a system that gives you a confirm every action, like even a like or something, because you can accidentally just be scrolling down a feed, your thumb touches like, and now all of a sudden some maniac thinks you agree with them.
Yeah,
you know.
No, you're so right. Yeah. This keeps me up at night.
Well, other breaking news. Anyone else got breaking news before we go back to music business?
Well, yeah. Remember the coffee that we've been talking about that I got onto the ultra hipster coffee service?
Oh, yeah.
We've been
drinking
that. Did
we talk about this on a podcast already?
Yeah, we talked about the fact that I had finally got on the list but hadn't tried it yet. So bags have arrived. They show up on a guy on a bicycle, drops them off at my house every Friday. I've been bringing some over to you guys. I like it.
Yeah.
I've not liked every single bag that we've tried, but it's such a variety.
This coffee you're meant to use, not the bag. Yeah, I like the Ethiopian stuff.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it like single origin blends?
Most of it is, yeah.
Mm. Mostly single
I love
origin.
Ethiopian.
So what? I don't know much about it. He has his own roaster or something like that? Is that?
Yeah, it's called Tristero Coffee or Tristero Coffee. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. And he's basically just a single guy, from what I understand, roasting coffee, getting single origin stuff from all around the world, and then roasting limited quantities. So you place your order on Wednesday for a Friday delivery. He roasts on Thursday and delivers it Friday, and he only roasts what is ordered that week. And he has a limited kind of list of people that, because he can only do so much. So he kind of takes on clients every now and then. Clients. But you know, it's reasonably priced, the same price you pay for any nice coffee from whatever Intelligentsia or Blue Bottle or whatever, and it's really great coffee. And it's cool because he puts all the flowery descriptive language, but it's all so fairly non-pretentious. Like, this tastes like cherries, marzipan or whatever, and then you taste it and it's fairly accurate, even for like a non-tasting
person.
So he
must just
like
be
me.
Buying like green beans basically in massive bulk.
Yeah. I mean,
I would like to ask him or anybody out there about popcorn lung, and you know, because I think roasting coffee is very dangerous.
Right, that's what you would say. We said, why don't we just roast our own coffee?
Is it really?
Yeah
because
according
of the
to the CDC, yeah, it's like the same thing as popcorn lung, which sounds ridiculous, but it's when, you know, like people working in popcorn roasting, there's a chemical that gets released, and it gets in it over, if you expose to it over long periods of time, you get popcorn lung.
I'd imagine that he would probably just say it's the price he's willing to pay because he
sounds like a purist.
Yeah, into coffee.
So great. That's one thing that I learned, a little fact about coffee, is that green beans, before you roast them, they can last a really long time.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Years, right? Or at least
a
year.
Yeah, I think like a year. Yeah.
Before, and then you can still roast them, and it'll still be fresh. Yeah. Once you roast it, that's when the shelf life really starts to kick in.
Well, can I ask what your preferred brewing method is?
If I take one to an island, I think I'd have to take espresso. But we used to do pour overs, but we got this. What brand is that? That Bonavita, is that what that is? Or no, it's, I can't remember what it is, but it's like a, it's a pour over. It's just a coffee maker, but it's got this like shower head, so it evenly distributes the water.
Yeah, it's like the
and
brewing.
It keeps the temperature not too hot.
It's the brewer. It's just a simple brewing coffee that you would see in an office or anywhere, but it tastes. Yeah. It does taste better.
It does taste better. Yeah.
Why? What's yours, Adam?
I use a Chemex every day.
Yeah.
This I've just is perfected this it, is so the, I'm scared to move
I was,
on
I was making Chemexes, and then I got lazy, and I stopped caring about coffee. So I got one that does it automatically. And it's a, you know, 10% worse.
I'm just a pour over guy. I've got the Melita pot, and there's one burner on my stove that is able to go low enough to keep it at the right temperature. Awesome. So I put my pot within a pot.
I'm an espresso guy. The guys all got me a really nice espresso machine for my wedding, like a wedding present. And I can't get away from those. But it's funny, on these beans that we got, like you were saying, you like the Ethiopian, whatever, Yirgacheffe
or something. For pour-overs, yeah.
Yeah. You try that as an espresso and it doesn't work, or vice versa. You know, it's funny how much it does change the
totally
method.
Agree.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, kind of on the coffee thing, we all went, other breaking news is we all went to Hawaii with wives and girlfriends, and we stayed at a place that was surrounded by coffee farms. None of the coffee we had was really that great.
No, yeah.
I'm not a coffee aficionado or whatever, but it wasn't anything spectacular, but it was so cool seeing like some of these little properties. They're 3-acre, 2-acre properties, had 2,000 trees on them, 2,000 coffee trees on them, and they're all part of like a co-op where they all provide their coffee to one of the farms to actually roast it or process it. But they're just everywhere. We were on the Big Island, and it was just crazy seeing, like, everywhere you go, there's fruit farms and coffee farms, and they're all kind
honey
of micro
farms.
Yeah, honey farms. We were staying next to the biggest, I think the biggest, second biggest honeybee farm in the country.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. They had millions and millions.
Well,
of
bees. So you were saying that they actually, in addition to making honey, they provide bees for other places that need bees around
on the island. They don't take their bees off the island.
Okay. So, but people are getting bees from them for pollination and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they do. I think the other farm does provide bees to the rest of the country.
No, they were saying they don't take their bees anywhere off their island, which is kind of cool because we got a whole education in the bee farming industry and honey farming industry.
They were quite unequivocal about their belief of what was causing colony collapse.
They thought it was
nicotine-based pesticides and almond farms. There's like a million-acre almond grove, and you'd have to go look into this, but every time the bees go visit this almond every year when they go pollinate the almond trees, 3 weeks later, 50% of them die because they have to use so many nicotine-based pesticides in the almond.
And there's a parasite that they also get because their immune system goes down. It was like they're pretty, like Danny said.
Yeah, the guy hated almonds. Let's put it that way.
I like almonds, but it just seems like we don't need almond milk. I'm all for people that, you know, if you don't like dairy,
where is the almond's nipples?
Yeah, how do you milk an almond? But can you imagine how pissed the bees would be if they got transported from, like, beautiful Hawaii, 3 billion different flowers, and they're like, here you are in Iowa, suck on some corn.
Well, that was the other thing, is that when they transport them in trucks, and this is in the United States, not this farm, they don't do that, but they transport them on trucks for thousands of miles, and they feed them corn syrup. And then they even dilute the honey with corn syrup and things like that. It's like
the Mormon ones have to use Pepsi corn syrup.
So anyway, we'll throw up a couple pictures of the coffee that we're talking about, Tristero coffee, and then also our trip in Hawaii. It was pretty amazing. Have you been to Hawaii?
I have. My sister, who just went, was just visiting me this week and lives there. So,
which island?
She lives in Honolulu. She's married to her husband's in the army, so they moved from Alaska to Hawaii this year. So they're in the Big Island. So I'll probably try to get there in the next year or so, see them.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's a good move.
Yeah, although Alaska's also really cool. You know what's funny though is I was born and raised in Western Illinois, and I love weather, and I like cold weather, and I like snow and fall. And she said the same thing. She's like, I'm going crazy right now. Like, it's 80 degrees every day, and I just want it to snow, or I just want it to be cold. And she's like, I prefer Alaska to Hawaii every day. I was like,
that's the crazy thing about Alaska. We were on the Big Island. They had like a foot or more of snow on the top of it because it's at 14,000 feet. In fact, we'll post some pictures. Yeah, we went up to the top of, to the Keck Observatory and watched the meteor shower that happened. We happened to be there that week that it was happening. And, you know, you forget there's an actual Milky Way out there that everyone talks about. Because in L.A. you see like four stars, the brightest, you know, like the sun.
George Clooney. D-list. Only D-list stars, too.
You really get a sense D-list of how stars. You really get a sense of how flat the Earth is, you know. No, yeah, that was one of the coolest things. Some of the meteors, if I didn't know it was a meteor shower, I would not have guessed these were meteors. Some of them were moving. They would last for 30 seconds, 45 seconds. They were moving. It looked like a speck of dust just slowly floating around the air. That's how crystal clear the sky was and how bright and how slow some of these meteors were.
I went out in my backyard and tried to watch it, but it probably wasn't nearly as good as you. And I saw a bunch. I saw like two a minute. Jeez. So yeah. I bet you guys were just...
So you were saying, like, while we're talking vacations, you're heading up to Mammoth to go snowboarding.
Yeah, this weekend. I'm going to spend New Year's in Mammoth.
And then Dylan was... I know every time we talk about snowboarding, Dylan gets jealous because he used to snowboard a lot. And then since we started touring, just because of time, there's no thing. And then also we all said to him and to ourselves, like, if you break a wrist, there's like 2 or 3 months of touring that we can't do or recording. So it's a frustrating, I know.
Last year was the first time I went in 3 years because we were touring for those 3 years and I could never had enough time that I was weighing, if I break a wrist, do I have enough time to recover for the first show of the year or something like that? And last year I had enough time if I broke something to recover.
I mean, we would trust you more if you learned to carve.
Well, you know what's funny about, I guess this isn't funny, but years ago, I think it was over the holiday break, Linkin Park's old manager was, I'm sure he'd be fine with me telling the story. He was in Austria or France skiing in the middle of nowhere, broke his leg, was like holed up in a hospital in a tiny, tiny little village for weeks. They had to they were trying to figure out how to like get him back here. Like they were looking into private planes and because he had a, you know, huge, it was a nut, but that's like the terrifying thing, right? It's so dangerous.
Yeah. And that's the manager's job is important enough. Yeah, right. You know, at least he doesn't have to perform.
At least he's not a soccer player.
That's true, right?
But so we'll move back onto kind of music business. Maybe we'll come to music only later. But yeah, we've talked a bunch about Linkin Park and we don't have to dwell on it. But obviously this year was a pretty big tragedy for Linkin Park and all their fans. What has it been like dealing with their socials and from your perspective with Chester, you know, having.
Yeah, well, nowadays I don't really deal. I mean, the guy who runs all their socials now, he was actually my former intern when I was with them. And so I don't really do a whole lot of that myself, but it's been interesting, right? Like it was 2 months after an album came out and we had to stop all promotion essentially. And, and dealing with it in the way of, okay, like we have to recognize that this happened. We still have an album out there with just really incredible music that he made that he would want the world to hear. So what's that fine line, you know, where we're not, you know, like it's crazy because I got a huge advertising budget. And when it happened, I cut off all the money and didn't spend a dime for months after because like just didn't feel right. And so it's been a interesting balance. And I think I'm really proud of the way we all handled it, if that makes any sense, like because it wasn't easy and we didn't always know if we were doing the right things. And it's just been a crazy
experience. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if everyone just lived a private life, then you know anytime some life event happens, you know, you don't have to think about these things. You know, it's when people blend their private and public lives and their persona is part of their business, it creates very blurry lines because you're going through real feelings. Everybody's going through real feelings and dealing with this real event. And it's there's no win, because if you don't acknowledge it, you know, then perception could be weird. If you do acknowledge it in the wrong way, it, you know, now you're having to consider these things when you're just trying to deal with something personally.
I think it happens in I don't know of anybody who knows, unless they've been through it a lot, you know, how to react to death, let alone suicide. Like, nobody knows what the correct reaction is,
right,
or how to it, you know, how to behave, because and if eventually that becomes an issue, because you have to act, right? You have to do stuff with your life, and in reality, I'm sure there was an element of paralysis in your internal state, like
and you know, it's it's Chester who's got millions of fans around the world, but at the same time, like, he's got a team of people. There's people at Warner Brothers who's been working with them since they were signed, and you know, it was very personal for a lot of us. And I mean, I went through stages of grief, and I wasn't even that close with him. Of all the guys in the band, he's probably the one I was the least close with. And I think I was so, for me personally, I was so torn up about it that I started feeling guilt. Like, I feel guilty that I feel this awful because I wasn't as close to him as I was with the other guys. And I mean, I put on weight. Like, it was rough. It was and I can't even imagine what his family went through. So, but yeah, it also kind of showed what we were made of, and like what that, you know, working with that band and that whole team was a highlight of my career. And I just think they have the best team ever. And it really just going through all this just really proved that and solidified that, because I think everyone was just so incredible and supportive of each other, and down from management to the label to just everybody. It was crazy. Yeah,
and also, like you said, that the timing of that must have been so difficult, because it's at the same time you're trying to deal with a private family matter, it's also music that he's written that he wants the world to see, and you don't want to be perceived as capitalizing on something, and you don't want to be perceived as insensitive, but it's just, you know, kind of so murky to deal with that from the business side of things as well.
I remember seeing a video of him that they posted afterwards of a few days before.
So,
and obviously we were on the outside, and this is completely distant. But the idea that somebody would have been able to tell his internal state doesn't seem that was quite revealing to me. Is that somebody in that state doesn't display it necessarily? Yeah. You know,
it's scary. Yeah. It is scary. So,
well.
Moving on.
Moving on, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's no, you know, even us just talking about it from a distance, and, you know, the couple shows that we did with them, you always kind of bring things back to yourself, because we're all, you know, living in our own world, and we think about ourselves, you know, and what if something bad happened to us, you know, and we were in that situation, you contemplate it, and it literally is, it's very difficult, and we realize how much time we spend avoiding those kinds of thoughts. We just don't want to deal with what the negative possibilities of life, you know, it's difficult. So.
Yeah.
Well, there's no easy segue, but, you know, sticking with the music business, you grew their socials from, you know, nothing to basically millions and tens of millions of followers. Now everything's changed. We wanted to talk a little bit from the kind of insider perspective, which I guess you're still not an insider. You're almost working against the machine of this idea of Facebook's and all social media now pay to play, which is like the term that is used to before. Well, you actually will do a better job of describing what pay to play now is.
Yeah. So Facebook, I mean, all social media really has an algorithm that if I post something on Linkin Park's 63 million follower Facebook page, 63 million people are not going to see it. It's usually really for them, you know, a few million will see it. And it's all based on Facebook's algorithm, where they are showing you the content they think you want to see, not just based on who you follow. So, if you want to reach more people, you have to pay to reach more people by online ads, you know. So that's definitely changed the way we do things. I don't hate it, because I feel like it makes our content better. I feel like if everyone who follows you just gets to see it, you're going to get lazy with your content. It's going to be garbage. But now we have to step up our game. And they, I mean, listen, they do get to dictate it. They came into my office 4 years ago, Facebook, I mean, and said, video is everything. Start posting more videos. And I said, okay. And sure enough, my posts were doing better. Everything was working better. So you really do have to listen. But it's made our content better. And,
it's made it better, you think, because if you're going to put money behind something, you take more care and you basically make the content better because you value it. I'm fucking paying for this.
That to a point, but more so because Facebook just comes out and says, don't use salesy garbage copy. Like, don't use that. Your posts are going to suck if you do that, and we're gonna put them down on the algorithm. Mm-hmm. Now the content should be more great. Or like, they want good content. So if the better your content is, meaning you're not saying click here to download or click here to stream or buy our tickets, they'll pump that up in the algorithm. So it just makes
the content better. It's pretty funny though, because like, I agree with that. Good content for them means they can make more money off general advertising. So they're encouraging non-commercial, non-advertisey bullshit posts so that their numbers grow. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing. I mean, it's obvious. They're a business. Like, you see, we have people that always posting these things about how, like, Instagram censoring them because they want to post a picture that they took and there's some butt crack showing or, like, a nipple. It's like, look, I'm with you. Free the nipple, free everything. But it's a fucking private service. Like, you're not being censored by the government.
Right.
So I think there's a weird thing.
With business interests. Yeah. They're motivated, obviously.
And we find ourselves complaining about it because we post something and it gets throttled or it doesn't show up. But I think from our perspective, what it's made us think about doing, and part of the reason we're doing this podcast, is to have a more direct connection with our fans and anyone that's interested in what we're doing, not on any pre-existing platform,
yeah,
or being platform agnostic, as they call it, because we found, like, we've got 200,000 followers or something on Facebook. When we do a post, we're lucky if we get, I don't know, what's Dylan, what are the latest numbers?
I mean, we're lucky if a couple thousand people see it,
yep,
even. Not, yep, let alone like it or engage with it. We're lucky if we get a couple thousand people to
see
it.
And you get the pop-up that says every time you do a post, promote this post to reach your fans. And it's fine. We accept Facebook's a business, but we're also trying to think, how can we directly connect via podcast, via our own website, our own newsletter, and that sort of thing.
And I think that goes back, and I swear I'm not like trying to defend Facebook, but look what this, like,
who do you work for, Adam?
But like, look what that's made you guys do. It's made you guys think like, oh, we can't just post to our 200,000 fans. Like, let's start a podcast. Like, I think it makes
let's leave Facebook.
Let's leave it. And I mean, you know, maybe, right?
Yeah, I think that's the idea that that kind of access wouldn't eventually develop a price is ridiculous.
Yeah,
when in the history of the world, yeah, has a person been able to instantly publish to millions of people? You know, like, and of course it's going to develop a price, and of course it's going to be monetized and develop a market and everything.
Yeah, I think you're right. The upside of it is that content from people like bands, artists that have actual engaging content to offer has gotten better. The downsides that I've seen now are this kind of subversive, real, this advertising basically in a different type of language. Now you see all these things that say, you'll never guess what just changed my life. And then it's an advertisement for something.
Oh,
you know? And that doesn't get throttled because it's using a certain language that's beating the algorithm's detection of it or whatever, you know?
I think Facebook right now is the garbage I see on there all the time.
It's, yeah,
like the organic content that's getting pushed through to my feed somehow. I'm like, why is this showing up in my feed? Like,
yeah, mm-hmm,
they still haven't figured it out. There's forced, still garbage content.
It's forced advertising. I mean, South Park season or two really nailed it. Basically, because algorithms have become so intelligent at detecting ads and therefore either blocking them or throttling them, people now have become the ads.
Mm-hmm. The vehicle, yeah.
The vehicle for this. And I think it was two seasons ago, South Park just fucking nails this concept. There was also a movie a couple of years ago, I think, called Keeping Up with the Joneses with David Duchovny, where basic premise is there's a family, in quotes, moves into a neighborhood, and it's basically four actors, two kids and parents, and they've got all the latest, coolest shit. Like, you know, he's driving the new Audi, and they just live in that little cul-de-sac, and all the neighbors are like so impressed with them because they're such a good looking, like happy, amazing couple that they're like, oh, he got the new Ping golf clubs. Like, I don't. David's really good. I should get those. You know, it's like
a good movie idea, but I don't even think it needs to be thought of as that sinister. Like, people do that anyway.
Yeah.
You know, people are so obsessed with the newest brand or the newest idea or the newest this or that they're going to do it. You don't need to force them, or you don't even need to force
who
them.
Who was that? Who was the designer who? Was it Gucci or one of those people who first came up with the idea? Why don't we just put our brand on the clothing? And yeah. It was like an original idea. It was like, nobody had ever thought to just wear branded clothing before.
They're like, now, these idiots will just advertise for us.
Well, that's one aspect of social media that maybe some people don't think about, is that when you get enough followers that you actually have influence, you know, in the world, you get hit up by every single brand, like, and they don't want you to say, hey, buy this. They just want you to be wearing something or have, you know, have this product in the background on your next selfie, you know, and that kind of shit. And these people make real money for seemingly doing nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten a whole shitload of detox tea in the mail.
This is why we're talking about all the coffee that we're talking about. We're not actually getting paid for any of that. We're not getting paid for anything, but we're, you know.
Full disclosure, nobody ever hits us up.
Full disclosure, we're not opposed to it.
Yeah.
So let's go back to music, like actual music. And this week we were going to talk about music from Mali, which, if anyone's ever listened to us in an interview, we always talk about this band called Tinariwen. They're a desert blues folk rock band.
It autocorrected to male music, by the way, in the list.
On our list of what we're going to talk about. But there's also a ton of other great music from Mali that we've been listening to lately. Jesse, I know, is always referencing Amadou and Mariam tracks.
Yeah, it's this band from Mali. It's actually a couple. They're married, and they're both blind. And it's, you know, that's not the main feature of their music, but it's just interesting that they make music together. And it's a little more on the pop side, but it's still got this unbelievable sound that I don't know why Mali is such a special country. Out of all the countries in Africa, there's so much music seems to come out of there. You know,
they have a very strong musical history, like classical musical history, as in like a almost similar to the Indian system of masters and schools, you know, passing down.
Salif Keita's, you know,
a lot of the pop musicians are viewed negatively by that the side of Malian music. I think even Salif Keita, like, he's viewed as, you know, veering from the. But he's amazing, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I'll let them have those subtle debates within their community. I'm just going to enjoy the music. Yeah. So check it out. I'm going to do it in Mariam. We'll put a link up. It's if you ever want to put on music at a party and seem super hip, then, you know,
yeah,
get some of that. Like they've you know, they're pretty well known. They've opened up for Coldplay and done things like this. And, you know, they seem to be one of those bands that people, like, they want to just buy some cool. You know, they'll take them out on the road as an opener, or, you know, like, we put them on. We have a bunch of their music on our walk-up, not walk-up music. What do you call our playlist before we come on stage?
Before we enter the ring.
Yeah.
There's another band. We'll just throw a bunch of links up to various Mali bands called Tartit. And for me, they're like, if you liked Tinariwen before they were cool, then you'll like Tartit, because they're like they're the raw version of Tinariwen. But they have some of the most amazing, what we always refer to, I think a lot of people refer to, as this egg roll rhythm, which is basically a, you know, it's not a circle. So you imagine an egg rolling, you have this gudunk, gudunk, this uneven distribution of the rhythm, and they've just
different
got
than the Chinese egg roll.
Yeah. So if you will throw up a link to some of their stuff and just listen to these grooves, where if you try to count it, as in like 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4, even though you can, there, you know, it's a can be subdivided into fours or into an octave, you just can't feel it that way. They're feeling it in a completely different way that is best described by eggs rolling down a hill. So we'll throw a couple links up. What are you working on? Who are some bands you're working on that you're really into now?
So I think I mentioned them earlier, but I worked on the last Mastodon album. If you don't know Mastodon, they're like a psychedelic heavy metal just insane musicians. These guys shred, man. And, you know, when I first got assigned to them, I was not really that excited about it. I was like, what am I going to do on Mastodon? And, I've had the most fun ever working on these guys. They kind of let me do what I want. Most times with a artist, I have to run things through by the manager who runs it through the band, and there's all sorts of layers and all sorts of red tape. And these guys say yes to 99% of the things I want to do. And they're up for 2 Grammys this year. So I really hope they win. So that's been a blast. I worked on Liam Gallagher last year.
How often do you get to see the bands you work with? Did you get to see them this year? Or?
So funny thing, been working in the music industry 10 years. Toured the world with Linkin Park. I hate going to concerts.
Oh, you're like us.
I never go to shows. I don't know. After work, I really just want to go home. So I think I would have gone to see Mastodon this year. I think I was out of town or something. Usually it's more of an artist relations thing. If an artist is in town, they my boss likes us to go so they can see us supporting the artist. But if I have a preference, I won't go.
Yeah, the label always gets super drunk at our shows. They take up double the spots they need. Half of them don't show up, and then they're plastered. So I think that's generally an indication of what they want to do is not go to shows.
In their defense, if you had to go see every one of your bands and artists, I would fucking hate it.
You know what's funny is especially the marketing directors, I don't know what your label calls them, product managers or whatever, but sometimes they're seeing bands 50 times a year, and I'm like, oh, kill me, and it's nothing against the artists, it's just like.
Yeah.
Well, I think our label skews our ticket sales because whenever we play in New York or LA, they have offices, their big offices are New York or LA. As soon as the tickets go on sale, they buy 100 or 200 tickets sometimes so they can invite all their friends and whatever. And then sometimes they don't even fucking use them. So we've sold all these tickets and then the room's, only 75% full.
Yeah. It's a big thing. I know at Warner, when we do ticket buys, we're really precious about it. I don't know how your label does it, but my wife never comes to shows with me ever. If you don't show up for a show, you're going to hear about it the next day because they know who shows up and who doesn't. And we're paying for those tickets. So show up or don't.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good system because, the accounting that labels do is very, very weird, and we won't get into too many details, but,
it makes the Big Short seem on the level.
So, you think, oh, cool, we sold these tickets, we're going to get that money, and then somehow we find that bill on our bill somewhere. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? You bought these tickets, you're charging us for them, and you didn't show up,
The funny, it wasn't an intentional thing on their part, but it's always stuck out in our mind as the perfect epitome of this. Which is they just have a system, right? If you're not at the top of a label, you've got a credit card and business expenses go on that, and then somewhere down the line that gets added to a spreadsheet and blah, it gets accounted for. So the funniest thing was getting offered coffee when we went to our label's offices. And then just finding that on our recoupables later. We said, we actually said, we're going to go get coffee. And whoever the assistant was said, oh, no, let me get it. You guys are at Sony at a $3 billion building in Manhattan. And she got us the coffee. And then we found that on our statement.
The coffee shop was in their building, too. Yeah.
They charged us to offer us coffee. It was almost like what we do with a beer there.
You saw on the coupable statement, $14.82 for
and
coffee. What?
And Danny is saying, it's ridiculous, and we joke about it all the time, but it's not even necessarily the assistant's fault who did it, because she pays for the coffee at the Starbucks in the building. The receipt gets turned in. The business department says expense, add to spreadsheet.
In the assistant's defense, I have no idea if my artists are getting charged for my expenses or no clue.
Yeah,
I have no idea how that works.
Because if I was being truly cynical about it and I was running a multi-million-dollar and billion-dollar industry, I would not want people who have to relate to people to have that on their conscience. I would want to separate them from...
You just ruimed it for me. Now I'm going to know. Next time I go out to a lunch, I'm like, do you guys know that the artist is paying for this?
Mastodon is sitting around having a band meeting. That fucking asshole, Adam Reamer, keeps putting hot dogs on our...
Hot dogs? Disturbed. What's all this cotton candy that Adam's been buying?
All right,
what
so let's
member berries.
Member berries. We can
let's talk about the lounge.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the lounge, and then I also wanted to talk about after the – we had an epic party after the Johannesburg Linkin Park show.
Oh, yeah.
That we can get into. So let's start with the lounge.
Yeah, so the way we met Adam in the very embarrassing way where we invited him to come hang out in the lounge with us, and then we realized that we couldn't get in, and we could get in, but we had to pay for the guests. So, in our defense, we were too embarrassed to not let you in because we invited you. So we like that eating that cost was a pleasure for us. Like, oh fuck, we can get him in, we can hang
out. That's on your recoupable statement. Well, by the way.
Well, funny because had you not paid, I probably just would have put on the Linkin Park credit card anyway.
So I still think the Virgin Lounge is the best lounge I've been in.
That was incredible. It's the only lounge
I've
been in.
A lot of lounges around the world, and. This one, they had a fucking recording studio in there. I didn't use it, but they had a Pro Tools system, and you could go and mix a record in there if you wanted. They had
an Avid suite, an editing suite.
Yeah, they had
with a big screen for editing. If a filmmaker wanted to come and edit,
should have gone to cut a
like
song.
Batman's assistant's name. What's his?
Michael Caine.
No, yeah, but what was his name? Like his persona or the
his character?
Something like Rupert or something.
Oh yeah, it's something like Rupert or Alfred or something.
Alfred.
Yeah. Every waiter in there was like this. Was an Alfred. Yeah.
That was our first.
Excuse me, would you like a G&T?
That was our first lounge experience. So we were like the Beverly Hillbillies because. You see the list of like champagne and scotches and then, selection of cheeses. And we didn't know whether you had to pay for it or not.
We were whispering, is this free?
Is this free? And you could tell there must have been people going like, oh, who let these people in?
Oh, they had a steam shower.
Yeah, they did.
And a massage parlor.
And a hair salon.
Yeah. I just remember it was one of those feelings where you feel like a fish out of water. Because do you remember when I sat down and I tried to order, we'd been ordering cola tonics and lemonades in South Africa. And I tried to order one of those and he didn't understand what I said. And then I got the fear that I was like, oh wait, is that a real thing? Or, is that a real drink? So he just threw me into this loop where eventually he said, you want a tonic cola, a lemonade? I was like, mm-hmm. I basically just agreed to whatever drink he offered me.
That was, if you have to have a 7 or 8 hour layover, that's where you want to do it. You can go take a nap. There's big screens everywhere. Really good food. It's huge. That one. I mean, there was like maybe 20 people in there, and it was probably 10,000 square feet of luxurious loungy area. And we had to go sit in each area, order a drink from each bar, try all the food, and
it was really good food in the UK. So clearly, it wasn't British people making it, but
yeah, they had all foreigners making the food because we know they can't cook.
Yeah. So the other thing, right before that, 2 days before that, we played the Johannesburg show at Soccer City Stadium, and we were obviously all super excited about doing that. We went back to our friend's house who we were staying at. And had an epic drinking party. And I just have this memory in my head of this friend of ours, Ilya, who for like an hour was forcing us to drink wine. I mean, literally pouring it down our throats, yelling at us in our ears that he had personally stomped these grapes. Because some of our friends in South Africa, just for fun every year, buy, 300 kilos of grapes. And stomp and make their own wine and their own grappa from that. And it was pretty damn good wine.
I was going to say, to be fair, South African wine is some of my favorite wine.
Yeah, this was my friend's...
Oh, so never mind.
Stinky feet wine.
Stinky feet wine. And I've never had that bad of a hangover in my life because it started off with at the stadium. It wasn't the wine's fault. No, it started off at the stadium. People seeing us walking around saying, here, you got to have a... Brandy and Coke, which is the big drink in South Africa, is Brandy and Coke. And you start with that, then someone gives you vodka, tequila, and then you finish with handmade wine. Yeah. And it was brutal. Yeah. I remember Jesse was...
That was the drunkest I've ever been in. I take responsibility for it, but I also don't, just because it was quite stressful, It was our biggest show ever, opening for Linkin Park. Walking on stage and seeing and hearing 65,000 people, and it takes 10 seconds for you to hear the sound, for it to come back and echo it, we were all a little stressed out. And then we went up to the radio station suite where they also had free drinks. And you just want to wind down. And then before you know it, you know, all our best friends live in South Africa and we ended
before
up...
Before you know it, you're in the bathroom at 7 in the morning, passed out. Yeah, that was... Michael and I were... What were you going to say?
No, I was going to ask Adam if he had any experience in South Africa for those 10 days that you were there that they drink more than most people in the world. Like, maybe only the Irish or the... some Eastern European countries or like Russia can compete with the South Africans.
No, not really. I mean, I had just been, we had just done a world tour and I had been living on a bus with like roadies who can throw back. So, no, I don't think anything stuck out with me in South Africa other than it was
that you didn't experience it because we've been on buses with roadies and all that. And there's something about the South African liver, which is just undefeatable.
I feel like I missed out now. I got to go back.
Well, we'll show
it's
you
not, it's clip. Honestly not an experience I would wish upon my worst enemy.
We'll show you a clip with, we always talk about him, our beloved tour manager, Mick, who is, among the roadies, a god of drinking. And we'll show you the docu-series we're working on. We have an amazing bit of footage of him in South Africa.
Yeah, imagine this, a tour veteran. He's been on the road since he was 18 years old. He's Scottish. Oh. He's a big guy. He can handle his liquor. And he was being tested by the fucking South Africans.
Wow. We'll show you a clip of that when we get done here. So let's move on to gear. We're going to talk about, what are we talking about this week? Oh, Jesse said to us, we never talk about drum stuff, so here we go. Get your sleeping bags out.
I'm going to make it short and sweet.
You're getting drool on the mic, will you just?
I already wiped the drool off my face before. Let's talk about the drums. We're going to talk about my hi-hats because of all my drum stuff, that's the thing I get the most comments on, especially, you know, with local techs or, you know, backline guys. They see me get out my hi-hats and they're really big. I use 18-inch hats on live shows. At some point, I was even using 20-inch hats. Now, to non-drummers, that's very big. It's like, imagine the biggest New York slice pizza you can imagine. And that's how big my hi-hats are. The hi-hats are the two cymbals that sit on top of each other and kind of make a chip, chip, chip sound.
They're crash cymbals that you've taken to.
Yeah, I take crash cymbals. Even sometimes a ride cymbal and a crash cymbal. And I guess to be sincere about it for a moment, I mixed a lot. I do a lot of the mixing on our records, so I know how things sound when they're mic'd up. And I have a lot of conversations with Mick, our front of house engineer. And the small hi hats work for certain kind of music. It's that kind of ch-ch-ch-ch sound. And for our music, the bigger ones seem to work better because they just fit in the mix. That it's funny enough, the bigger they are, sometimes the more gentle they sound. And they do fit in the mix very well. And
you nicknamed them Gentle Giants.
Gentle Giants, yeah. So if I haven't lost too many listeners in my bet by now, I just wanted to give a shout out to my hi-hats from Peisty. right now I'm using a 18-inch Rude Crash Ride. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, I like that whole...
Modern Essential 602 on top.
Despite all my, I like making fun of drums the most for some reason because they're the most disproportionately priced. They're so expensive for something that makes one ding dong ding. But I do like that Rude series a lot. On all the Rude stuff on the Peisty side.
Do you guys know any good drummer jokes? I know one.
Yeah,
how can you tell if the stage is level? Drool is coming out of both sides of the drummer's mouth.
Yeah, there's a million of them, and I've heard them all, and that's why...
They're usually the same as the guitarist jokes.
Yeah. That's why when everyone asks me, you know, what do you do in the band? Well, I play drums on stage, but I started on piano, so... what do you call a guy who hangs out with musicians? A drummer? You know, I try and sort of mitigate that.
What's the difference between a drummer and a pizza? A pizza can feed a family of four.
All right, so Adam's favorite gear item of the week. You said you don't really have much gear or apps that you use, but you said you'd want to talk about YouTube Analytics.
Well, YouTube Analytics specifically. I mean, analytics in general, but YouTube Analytics, and I hope I'm not going to now bore them even more.
If you do bore them, you won't bore us. We're into this stuff.
Because I feel like if you're not using analytics, you are missing out, and YouTube does them better than anyone. And you can really find where your fans are coming from, how they're consuming your content, you know, are they watching it on the watch page? Is it embedded somewhere? I mean, I've seen music videos blow up, and I was working on this one artist a few years ago, and all of a sudden the views were just skyrocketing on his video, and I couldn't figure it out. And I dug into the analytics, and I saw that it had got embedded on this random site. And then I could find from there why and how, what search terms were coming in. And basically, like, you can find the source of where your fans are coming from. And YouTube is such a – I think it's one of the most important discovering platforms for discovering music. So for your up-and-coming artists, it is vitally important that you're checking that out. I mean,
like detective work.
Yeah, it really is.
So how do you use it once you – like in that example, when you found the source, what did you do to kind of keep it or flame the fire?
Okay, so this – I have a very recent example actually is on Michael Bublé. You know, he's got this massive Christmas album that came out like 7 or 8 years ago, and I just got assigned the project, and I was kind of going through all of his YouTube videos, and for some reason, all the videos of the Christmas stuff weren't getting tons of views, and so I went in and I re-optimized everything. I retitled everything, redid the descriptions, redid the tags, changed the thumbnails on all of the Christmas
videos. Hey, do you want to work for us?
and 3 days later, because YouTube updates the analytics every it takes 3 days, everything jumped. There was nothing else going on, and everything jumped by a few hundred thousand views. So I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take all these off, re-upload everything, and see what that does. And we went from like 300,000 daily views to 1.3 million daily views like that, just because you're optimizing. And I was going in and seeing what was registering with people and why they were finding it and how they were finding it.
So, I mean, if you haven't seen the back end of the YouTube analytics, it is really insane, because you can get down to like district in a city, watched 4 minutes of this video, and they got there via a mobile device on a Thursday, and they clicked on they were searching for Congo's pizza. Yep. Or whatever, like you can see absolute specific details of how people arrive at your stuff.
And if you know how
which
to
actually
use...
is a pizza restaurant somewhere, right? Yeah.
And if you know how to use YouTube, you know, like I was having drinks with a friend the other night who works at a publishing company, and I was telling him, like, I was like, we were at a brewery called Lincoln Brewery, and I said, I pulled out my phone and I found a video of my really terrible pop punk band from high school, and I said, I'm going to make my band's video show up in the search results for this brewery. He was like, what? 10 minutes later, I said, pull out your phone, open YouTube, and he typed in Lincoln Brewery song, and my band's video popped up. And it's like, if you really know how to use the platform and dig in, there's so much you can do, and it's so huge for discovering artists. So,
yeah. I mean, I think it's probably our strongest social network, and we use it a lot, but we don't use it enough, I think, because the Come With Me Now video, you know, it's that song that everybody knows, and most people don't know who we are, and it's one of the problems we're dealing with in our, you know, how do we get to that next level of our career? And that video has got like 70, 80 million views or something like that. So I think, you know, that's one of the things we're working on. It's like, how do you drive those people to kind of check us out or see what we're about, you know, beyond that song?
And I think that's the thing, right? Like, especially if you know, I had to, so Disturbed came out with a cover of The Sound of Silence 2 years ago, and it just exploded. I mean, that thing went nuclear. And so I worked with their guy, with their videographer who was on tour with them, and we were posting tour live videos, behind the scenes, very simple stuff. He was uploading them to Facebook already on his own, and I would just rip them and upload them to YouTube, and I created all these playlists, and all I was trying to do was keep people in the ecosystem. I wanted them to see The Sound of Silence and then go, okay, what else is next? And how do I get them to listen to Down With The Sickness or whatever it is, you know?
And that's quite a big bridge to gap there.
It is.
Because that it was such a, what's it called,
it's kind of an off the wall cover, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, but because you're seeing such a diverse group of people that find you on YouTube from all over the world with completely weird ranges of what they like, you're not stuck anymore thinking like, okay, Disturbed is this hard rock band. Like that people don't have these genre boundaries anymore.
No. And I think it was a very surprising because we've got this massive song, but no one who listens to that's going to want to listen to Down With The Sickness. it's not true at all, actually. Right. Like, we brought on... their album just went platinum, like a rock album in 2017.
Yeah,
like,
it's unheard of.
Doesn't happen, you know? Yeah. So we brought on a ton of new fans from that. And now the goal is when, you know, they put out their next album, I got to bring all those people over. I'm sure you guys know that struggle as well. All these people have seen Come With Me Now video. How do I make sure that they listen to the new music as well? So.
We're going to record Come With Me Now too.
You wouldn't be the first band
come
to try
with us
that.
Again.
We'll just name our next single Come With Me Now.
Come With Me Now
Empire
again.
Empire of the Sun, they put their first hit on their second album or on their third album, whatever. That was bizarre.
So you've also worked with, you know, segueing into the next segment.
I like it when you do that.
Yeah.
Oh, you noticed.
I wonder if anyone's noticing the pattern on these... the musical notes in between segments, but we'll leave that up to the listener. So we always have the segment, what's it like working with the band, or what's it like being in a band with your brothers, but you work with a few artists. One of them you mentioned earlier, which was Liam Gallagher, which are the infamous brothers. Uh-huh. If anyone's heard of Oasis, they know that like they're almost better known for their fights and their drama than they are for their music. So what's it been like working with Liam Lust?
I got assigned Liam... in like the spring, and I liked Oasis, like What's the Story, Morning Glory, amazing album, but I didn't really know a ton about them, and so I went and watched the documentary. If you haven't seen Supersonic, oh my god, go watch the Oasis documentary. It's incredible. And I was like, after I watched it, I was like, oh my god, what am I getting myself into? Because those dudes are just brutal. But I met Liam and he was really nice the first time I met him, and then I had to do a Reddit AMA with him in a hotel in Beverly Hills in the fall, and he wasn't in the best mood that day, but he was so it's been interesting.
But that's when they're in their finest form, is when they've got some gripes, you know.
That's the thing. I was a little disappointed that he was so nice the first time I met him. I was like, ah, I thought he was gonna be like really not nice.
He didn't insult me. I feel insulted.
So they
did you say Supersonic was the name of the documentary?
Supersonic, yeah.
Okay, we'll throw a link up to that.
I saw Noel also released an album.
Yeah.
And so the conspiracy out there is that they're friends. The conspiracy is that they're stoking the fire of their...
I think they just made up, actually.
Oh, really?
If you don't follow Liam on Twitter, it's amazing.
I saw a recent post, I don't know if it was Liam or Noel, where it was like talking about how much he thinks his brother's a twat or something like that. He's like, but if someone touched my brother... I'd stab him with a... He'll stab him with a broken bottle or something like
that. Yeah, so I mean, when they announce that they're headlining Coachella next year...
As Oasis,
$30 million or whatever it is. Yeah.
I would love that.
I mean, that's kind of the sort of perfect...
They want to buy an island. That's my theory, so that they can have their own Oasis.
That's kind of the perfect little... story of, you know, what a brother is like this person that you hate more than anyone, but you'll fucking, you know, you'll go to bat for them.
Are there any other bands that you work with, families?
Oh, probably. I have a list of all my artists stuck on a post-it note on my desk because I forget all the time who all my artists are.
How many are you working with right now?
God, 16-15.
Jeez,
I couldn't even name them all because it changes often, and it's a bummer. I hate when that happens. I think that might be the only family I work with. I worked on the band Family of the Year for about half a minute, and then we hired someone, and they're working on them now. But that's my only family band.
Is 16 kind of the limit of where you can work, or do you find that you get over-assigned?
Oh, yeah. Oh my god, I wish I only had like 5 artists. It's just not, you know, it's impossible to give everyone my full attention, you know, and so you have to prioritize, and you know, obviously Linkin Park or Disturbed or, you know, Michael Bublé are gonna come before the baby bands. But I take a lot of pride in that, like I try also not to let those guys go by the wayside, and I try to give everyone as much attention as I possibly can, because, you know, especially like the smaller bands, like I know them personally, unlike Liam Gallagher, you know? Yeah. So like I've got a personal relationship with them in a lot of instances. So.
Mm. All right. So for
deep thoughts this week, we started this podcast off, we just did a test to make sure we could hear everything, and you said you hated hearing the sound of your own voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably everyone feels that way, particularly when they haven't done a lot of it. When they haven't done a lot of it, and it's still, I think, weird for us even in this podcast because we don't listen to ourselves talking a lot. Why is that? I mean, there's an actual reason physically why, because the resonance of what you hear when you just talk is completely different than what you hear recorded back, because there's certain frequencies that are not reverberating in your head. So your voice often sounds, what, higher?
I don't know what the crossover is on your ear canal, but I think, you know, a lot of the lower frequencies come through your bone and through your body. You know, you're hearing with your whole head and with your...
So you feel like you have a full body.
You feel like
voice.
Morgan Freeman in your mind, and then you hear the recording, and it's very disappointing.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like this.
Yeah, Adam, what was the thing about your voice that you didn't like?
I always thought, like, in my head, I feel like I have like a really cool, like, oh man, I have a pretty cool voice, and then I hear it back, it's like that is not cool sounding at all.
Johnny Marlowe, our photographer from episode 3, said the exact same thing when he listens. Like, I sound like a fucking frog.
But I think that's the general perception that everyone has. They all listen and they're like, oh, I sound like a frog, or my voice sounds higher. And it is we talked about this with Marlowe. It is a strange thing to hear your voice
even
back.
Even people who love the sound of their own voice, when they actually hear it, they don't love the sound of their own voice, you know.
Unless they're on NPR.
Yeah. Well, that's because they got headphones on. And I, you know, this discussion could go a little deeper, I think. It's that every perception you have of yourself is through your own sort of outward-looking apparatus. You know, it's your eyeballs are looking outward. Your ears are hearing. They're not just hearing the sound in the room. They're hearing it through your chest and the actual vocal cords. So you have this subjective perception of yourself in every way.
$5 from Jesse.
Well, it was because it's the subjective charge. Yeah. Well, that was unavoidable. That was literally a perfect use of the word subjective. But when you have an objective measuring tool, like...
We're just wrecked money like, in the pot.
Like a recording device that picks up just the sound, then you hear back how it actually is, you know, existing in the outside world. Then there's that dichotomy, and it kind of throws you off guard because you just have this idea in your head of what you are. And
it's clearly without fail, even in today's age when you would think people have heard their voice more often, but without fail that happens. That a person who's not doesn't hear their recorded voice all the time. They say the exact same thing every single time.
I referenced this earlier. When I was in high school, I was in a really bad pop punk band, and it was me and one other guy who were the singers. And when he would sing songs, I would just cringe and be like, Jack, oh dude, sounds so, you're not even like on key, like let me just sing all the songs, bro, like I got this. And I go back and listen to that and I'm like, oh man, was I bad, like how did I not hear that back then?
You should try it out for American Idol.
Well, it's funny, some people do have, I think, an opposite response where when they hear it back, I think most of us hear it back and are self-conscious about it and think it sounds bad or not as strong as we thought it did. But there are those weird group of people that hear it back and just hear amazing shit.
Yeah.
Like the American Idol people that Dylan's talking about, that you're going, how can you not hear it? Like, you're actually being given an opportunity to listen to yourself now on recording and you still think it sounds good. You're insane.
Well, I think that's a combination of delusion and also not having trained ears, you know, or something like that. But what's also interesting is
isn't there a name for that kind of bubble, that kind of thought? There's a name for it, specifically that kind of like positive feedback loop bubble where you perceive something as positive and you start, you know, without sounding too secret-y and here, give me your money type spirituality, that they perpetuate themselves because they have a positive feedback loop in that sense.
Politician.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's also interesting, though, is that your voice is different constantly throughout the day. Like, there's all these things that are unconsciously influencing your voice and the tone of it or the depth of the voice. Like, if you're around alpha males or if you're around other, even just males with higher testosterone, people subconsciously and unconsciously lower the tone of their voice. And they've done studies where females find lower voices attractive. And no, but they do when they've done, you know, obviously blind tests where they just play recorded voices of people and they try to get them to rate their attractiveness. The lower voice is almost always beat out the higher voices. And so, especially around women, men will start to lower their voices. So, I mean, I can just imagine that's a pretty funny scene, if you can just imagine.
I mean, that's so obvious if you're at a bar, you know, guys all of a sudden start talking like that. That's where the bro kind of thing comes from.
We're talking about it. It feels like there's a point in your male development where you start to notice it in other people and yourselves. Like if you were behind or ahead in puberty, you know, all the other kids around you were like, hey, so we're going out to Shea 14 to watch a movie this week. And you're still sitting there going like, ah. It's like, you know, you're 13 years old on your bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
You start to compensate for that. And I think that gets into your subconscious and just becomes a habit. You don't even notice that you're doing it most of the time.
I think maybe Big Mouth or one of those things addressed it, but I remember specifically one summer where you go back to school and over the summer, like a kid, there's like one now man, you know, and you're like, what the fuck happened to that guy? That guy.
He's got a mustache.
Yeah. he's like diversifying his portfolio and talking. That's a very common place to hear that kind of, that typical over, you know, fake masculine voices in airport lounges with business people, because they'll be discussing very loudly on a cell phone in a place that should be quiet. Yeah, sure. I think we'll have a meet on Tuesday. I'll have Susan look at that, and they have this very specific kind of bullshit voice.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing happened probably with the advent of radio in politics. The same thing that happened, like the Nixon Kennedy debates, they always talk about on TV, where now the visual medium became so important. It must have occurred at the time of radio. Because before that, you were judged on the content, or more so on the content of whatever you'd see written, or like who knows what Abraham Lincoln sounded like.
Yeah. I think he's a specific example of some. He had a very funny voice,
right? And obviously, in the real world, it still would have had the same impact. But now, if 300 million people hear you talking like an idiot, so sounding like what they think of as an idiot, it's just going to kill your chances. You could be speaking the words of genius, and you know, it doesn't matter if you've got a funny little voice. Although it just doesn't seem to apply anymore in current politics.
It's true.
Having an idiotic voice.
Well, back to the actual sound of your own voice. Have you guys ever sort of tried to take note on when you're singing, you know, with headphones or in-ear monitors? Have you noticed the difference if you're on a digital console versus an analog console? Because I think I have. On digital consoles, because the signal is being, this is going to get technical for a second, but because the signal is being digitized and then it's turned back into an analog signal to get into the headphones, there's a slight delay. It's imperceptible. You could not actually pick out the delay. But I think the subconscious does actually pick it out, because when you're on an analog console, it's the speed of light. It's just the speed of electricity. It's so fast. And when we occasionally are on an analog console, there's zero delay between your voice and then when it comes back into your ears.
Yeah.
And so I've had experiences where that slight delay that I'm hearing, it separates you from your own voice in a way, especially if your headphones are loud. Now you're not really paying attention to the resonance in your head or your vocal cords. You're actually listening through your ears. So that few milliseconds of delay are now causing you to almost, it's almost like it's not your own voice.
Yeah. I've experienced that. And then also the amplified version of that is on that one video recorder that we have. That goes on top of cameras. You can monitor the headphones on that, and there's a big delay in the voice.
So you'll hear something in like, hi,
yeah, it'll go, hey, you have to listen to your voice delayed by a few milliseconds, or you know, maybe 20 milliseconds or something like that. And that you can't have a thought. You can't separate. You're so used to expecting that immediate feedback that it literally interrupts your ability to think.
They used to do that.
You can't talk and think on.
You go to a kid's science.
What's that?
Sorry, I was going to say, have you ever experienced that where you're hearing yourself like with an echo?
Yes. You know, you're right. Like you can't process the thought. After
They used to have it at science museums you'd go to as a kid. You know, you'd be able to go try out things. There'd be that where you could put on a pair of headphones and they had the perfect amount of delay where you meant to read a sentence out of a book.
Really?
It was at, I forget where it was. When I was a kid, went there. You meant to read a sentence from a book with the headphones on, talking into this microphone, and you can't get more than two words in because your brain just explodes.
Or like slow it down or something.
But I've noticed what you're talking about, Jesse, is that micro delay where it almost sounds like a different voice. It's a quick enough delay where I've been singing and almost like it frees up. thought space where I'm almost listening. It feels like I'm listening to a song, you know, listening to iTunes when we're playing, and I'll start to daydream. I'll start to have thoughts, and the thoughts will be more vivid, or I'll be entranced or like identified with the thoughts more than when we're on an analog board or whatever.
Yeah, I think because we do it so much and we've sung these songs thousands of times, you can go on autopilot and sing the same song. So now you separate the return signal so that you're hearing the your voice back with just a slight delay, and it's now separated from the act of singing by that delay. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you can just space out and listen to it as though you're not doing it. You know.
Well, it brings up the whole question of space-time, really, because...
Oh, boy.
Seriously, you're listening to something... Everything you're hearing or perceiving or viewing occurred in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to get right down to it, even at the speed of light, there's a delay of when that actually occurred. And it brings up the question of what... how that affects your perception. Like, I'm looking at all of you is a microsecond in the past by the time it hits my eyes. And from I don't know where the fuck this conversation goes.
Yeah, there's good videos that explain, like, the relativity of simultaneity, I think they call it.
Have you seen Interstellar?
Yeah, yeah. Apparently they were pretty accurate with their...
Awesome movie.
Yeah. Until they got to the bookcase, you know, interdimensional, right. which was slightly speculative.
Not just speculative. How do you explain that idea on a movie
the different rates of time and all that? I can't wrap my head around it. But the relativity of simultaneity is a visual. There's videos out there that you can wrap your head around that principle, which perfectly explains what you're talking about. But the example they use is a person on a train is traveling and towards a lightning bolt strike, and the lightning strikes the front of the train or just in front of the train, and then there's another person on the platform, and if they're aligned, the person traveling towards the lightning bolt is going to see it sooner than the person... there's two lightning bolts that strike either end of the train, and the person on the platform will see them as simultaneous, and the person in the middle of the train will see the front lightning bolt is occurring before the back lightning bolt. So because they're in
travel
motion, the events, there is no objective time. Time is purely subjective.
Right.
$5, please.
And that was probably a bad explanation, but you can go look it up and see what I'm talking about.
Well, I've just about had enough science for one day. And Adam, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us. You know, if we have to have a podcast just to hang out with you, you know, we'll do it because
it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
We'll do it without the podcast next time.
Yeah,
yeah.
We're gonna
the beer.
With the beer.
With the beer. Make sure you're stocked, please.
And you'll send us some links to all the bands that you've been working on. We can throw them up on our website.
Cool.
And all that.
That'd be awesome. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
And maybe any pictures that you have from the Linkin Park. Yeah. Show days, where, you know, or from that. Those.
And I got
Africa
one of
tour.
All of us in the Virgin Lounge somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, I did. Awesome.
Yeah. And then once we hit stop recording on this, we're going to pick your brains about YouTube analytics.
Yes.
All right. See you guys. Make sure you're subscribing on Google, Stitcher, Apple, wherever you're finding us. And head to congas.com/podcast to follow along. See you guys next week.